optimal minimal.
At this altitude, I can run flat out for a half mile before my hands start shaking.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Now would have seemed an appropriate time.
What if I did the opposite?
I'm a cybernetic organism, living tissue over a metal endoskeleton.
The Tim Ferriss Show.
This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens. I get asked all the time what I would take if I could only take one supplement. The answer is invariably Athletic Greens. I view it as all-in-one nutritional insurance. I recommended it, in fact, in the 4-Hour Body. This is more than 10 years ago, and I did not get paid to do so. With approximately 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food-sourced ingredients, you'd be very hard-pressed to find a more nutrient-dense and comprehensive formula on the market. It has multivitamins, multimineral greens complex, probiotics and prebiotics for gut health, an immunity formula, digestive enzymes, adaptogens, and much more. I usually take it once or twice a day just to make sure I've covered my bases if I miss anything I'm not aware of. Of course, I focus on nutrient-dense meals to begin with. That's the basis. But Athletic Greens makes it easy to get a lot of nutrition when whole foods aren't readily available. From travel packets, I always have them in my bag when I'm zipping around. Right now, Athletic Greens is giving my audience a special offer on top of their all-in-one formula, which is a free vitamin D supplement and 5 free travel packs with your first subscription purchase. Many of us are deficient in vitamin D. I've found that true for myself, which is usually produced in our bodies from sun exposure. So adding a vitamin D supplement to your daily routine is a great option for additional immune support. Support your immunity, gut health, and energy by visiting athleticgreens.com/TFS. You'll receive up to a year's supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your subscription. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/TFS, as in Tim Ferriss Show. athleticgreens.com/TFS.
The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's WORKLAB, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, boys and girls. This is Tim Ferriss, and welcome to another episode of The Tim Ferriss Show, where it is my job to deconstruct world-class performers, to figure out how they do what they do, and to dig into the details that you can apply to your own life. And this episode, we have a treat. We do not have an entertainer. We do not have an actor. We do not have a military strategist. We have a performance specialist, specifically athletic performance. And Ryan Flaherty, on Instagram, at RyanFlaherty1, the number one, was introduced to me by Dr. Peter Attia. And those of you who have heard my episodes with Peter Attia know that many good things come from Peter. This is no different. Ryan Flaherty is the Senior Director of Performance at Nike. Prior to holding that position, Ryan was the founder and president of Prolific Athletes, LLC, a sports performance facility in San Diego, California, where he trained some of the world's best athletes. His clients include, you may have recognized or heard of these names, Serena Williams, Russell Wilson, the Arizona Cardinals, Marcus Mariota, Jameis Winston, and hundreds of other professional athletes. And while he's perhaps best known for dramatically improving his athletes, that's the right word, speed, more and more athletes and coaches seek Ryan out for his training and guidance on injury prevention. And we dig really deeply into that in this episode. Many of his clients have made remarkable recoveries from injuries, and several NFL teams and European soccer clubs have sought out his methodology to implement into their own training programming. Ryan developed an algorithm called a force number that is based on the trap bar deadlift, also called the hex bar deadlift, and body weight to predict speed, such as the 40-yard dash. This was a really fun interview. We got into the weeds. We got very, very nerdy. If you enjoyed, for instance, the Pavel Tsatsouline episodes, the Charles Poliquin episodes, Dominic D'Agostino, or Peter Attia, then you are going to love this one. It takes us a few minutes, as it almost always does, to warm up. That's a limbering up round, and then we get into all sorts of stuff. We talk about exercises for reducing injury potential. We talk about the
force number and exactly how he uses the trap bar deadlift. What do exact workouts look like? Sets and reps, rest intervals. Lay it out, start to finish from warm up. What does one of these workouts look like? We talk about glued med exercises. Perhaps you saw some in Tools of Titans in Peter Attia's profile. That was directly from Ryan, and variations. We get into all sorts of nitty-gritty details, how he helped Meb Keflezighi, I think it is, train for his stunning Boston Marathon victory. How does he go from sprinting to long distance running? How does he predict which athletes are going to get injured? So whether you are trying to become a better athlete, you are trying to become less injured or more resilient in any type of training, or maybe if you're a bookie looking to bet on different teams and athletes or bet short certain teams that are going to get injured, there is something for everyone. So please enjoy my conversation with Ryan Flaherty, the savant of speed. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I have been hoping to connect for quite a few months now, and we've had a few actors behind the scene trying to connect us for a few months, and here we are. So I'm super stoked to dig in, and I thought we could just start with some basics. So you are very well known for saying that speed is teachable, coachable, but almost everyone out there says it is not. It is innate. So how did you come to that conclusion?
Sure. I mean, you know, first and foremost, I think when I was a young kid, kind of a funny story, but when I was young, I was playing baseball, and both my parents were athletic, and so they kind of knew some things about sports. And I hit a line drive to center field, and I got thrown out at first base. And I can remember my dad yelling, "Unhitch the trailer!" As I was running. I was running so slow, basically, which is not a good thing for a young kid to hear from his dad. In third grade, but I was really a slow kid when I was young. I grew fast and just couldn't develop speed. All the kids were faster than me in my class and my teams, and so my mom actually put me into track and field when I was young, and about fourth grade. And by the time I was in fifth, sixth grade, I was the fastest kid in my school. And what a lot of that was from was just me understanding and learning how to run properly. And so once I did that, it kind of opened my eyes to the idea that, you know, obviously it was not something I was born with in any way. But it's something that was learned, and it was a skill that I really put a lot of time into understanding and learning. And, you know, as I've gotten older and I've been in the sports performance, you know, training field for a long time. One of the things that, I think is, you know, kind of funny to me is I point out to a lot of people and parents is that, you know, if you can imagine if every sport played was in the swimming pool, one of the first things most kids would do would be learn how to swim. And yet every single sport on ground requires running. And yet we don't teach kids how to run. It's just kind of like throw them into the sport and they'll figure it out. But that's one of the big things I think I've been trying to help educate people on is that the most important thing you can do for your child is just teach them how to run properly. And then every other sport will kind of come easily to them. And I think, you know, over the years of more and more research putting into this, I've come to realize quickly through, you know, just the research is that speed is actually a skill you can learn and something you can train also.
And it seems to me like you have, just as you said, I didn't learn to swim. Speaking as someone who's extremely terrified of swimming and for a host of reasons, didn't learn to swim properly until early 30s.
Yeah.
It is incredible that anything on land that is dependent in part, whether it's NFL combine and you're doing something like a shuttle run. I mean, the difference between first place and say third, fourth, or also ran is highly dependent on the technique, number one, but also certain attributes that you can develop. And I'd love for you to share with us perhaps some of the experiments that you did at USA Track to figure out how to better coach speed.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I ended up taking, I needed a sample size that are all like similar skill level and talent level. And so I took 30, you know, Olympic A standard sprinters and ran them on force plate treadmills. And so the Olympic A standard sprinters are sprinters that have hit the required marks to qualify for the Olympics. Now in the United States, it's different just because we're such a high level that you have to be much better than just the standard, but in other countries and a lot of other countries, if you hit the standard, you're in. And so I took Olympic A standard sprinters and I test them on a force plate treadmill. And what I quickly realized was it wasn't about how much force they were creating or how great their technique was. It wasn't really until I realized that, I know you're familiar with the study that was done by Dr. Peter Wayand, which is mass specific force, is kind of king. It's more than anything, it's how much force you can create over what your body mass is. So to use it as an example, it'd be like if I told you to go run 100 meter dash as fast as you could with a 50 pound weight vest on, and I, you know, and recorded your time, and then we took it off and then we recorded your time, you'd be much faster without the 50 pound weight vest on. Well, inversely, if you were just to increase somebody's lower body strength by 50 pounds without adding a single pound of lean muscle mass, you'd also have the same results with improving their times based on them improving their lower body strength to mass ratio. And so quickly, I through that, the study of all the athletes, I realized, okay, so majority of what it comes down to for sprinters or for people to be fast is they have an insane amount of strength over what their body mass is. So an incredible ratio between that strength to weight ratio. And so with every athlete I train now, whether it's Serena Williams on the tennis court or you know, a football player that's going into the NFL combine, it's about teaching them how to improve that strength to weight ratio without increasing any lean muscle mass. So, I think that's the key. And then secondarily to that, you know, mechanics play a part. And, part of those mechanics, if you imagine, when you run, when you watch an athlete run from the side, their foot in their swing phase, when they're running, looks like it's making a circle. Well, if you have a big circle, a big wheel, that would cover a larger distance than a smaller wheel will. And so what I try to do is help them understand how to make larger wheels with their feet in order for them to cover more ground, which increases their stride length, which in turn helps them run faster times. Like, to give you an example, Usain Bolt takes 42 steps to run a 100 meter dash. Next fastest guy in the world takes 44. And so ultimately what you're trying to do in improving somebody's speed is helping them limit the amount of steps they take to run whatever particular distance they're going, whether it's a marathon or it's a 100 meter dash.
Which is also, in some respects, very comparable to Olympic swimming, right? I mean, you look at the sort of stride length and efficiency of top swimmers, and there's a direct parallel. Mm-hmm. Just a side note, I guess, which I've always wondered, you hear a lot, say, in certain running communities about striking with the midfoot and so on. How much attention do you pay to the impact point on the foot when you're trying to, say, increase the size of that wheel? Does that naturally lead to more impact closer to the heel, or is that something that has been overemphasized?
I don't think it's been overemphasized as much as it is the placement underneath the pelvis. So I think more than anything, it's kind of like where the foot's striking in relation to the center of mass is most important. So when you're looking at somebody who's with a midfoot strike, so I do focus on midfoot strike, but more than anything, I focus on where that midfoot strike is occurring, whether it's occurring, you know, out, you know, millimeters in front of the pelvis or directly under the pelvis or slightly behind. The goal is to get it as underneath the pelvis as possible. So you want the midfoot strike to happen under the pelvis, which is more of what I focus on in that big circle, the teaching of the mechanics with making that heel, you know, if you can imagine the heel stepping over your opposite knee when you sprint, is the goal. And so, upon ground contact and the landing phase, you want the foot to be as directly under the pelvis as possible.
And for sprinters, how much do you think about stride rate? People have read Born to Run. There are many books and they talk about, well, you should go from, say, 90 and aim for 180, and you should use some type of metronome or auditory feedback so that you're increasing your steps, footfalls per minute effectively. Mm-hmm. Well, how do you think about that in the context of what you do, if you do at all?
Yeah, totally. No, I absolutely do. And I think the biggest thing is, it's, again, everything I'm going to talk about today, it's all about specificity. As you know, like, once, if you're training for performance and for a particular sport performance, then you're going to train a very particular way that we're focused on, you know, the minutia of those things that will best help that person perform better. However, when you're transitioning into more of like a, you know, a static runner, or just in terms of training for health, a lot of what I'm going to say may not always apply, but it can apply in certain ways. And so I think, with that being said, I think, you know, the way I look at it is stride length and stride frequency, for the majority of the time, are products of how much force you create with the ground of what your body weight is. So your mass specific force, your stride rate and length is actually a product of that. So more than anything, instead of focusing on that, I'm focusing on one hand, the mechanics of sprinting, but I'm also focused on, if I know if I can improve strength to weight ratio in the weight room, which I think we can get into a little bit more depth later, is I know for a fact that stride length and stride frequency will also improve.
Those are byproducts.
Exactly. And so instead of focusing on one or the other, I just focus on the one that affects the other.
So you know, let's, Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so excited to jump into this. I'm getting a little overzealous. Go ahead.
Yeah, no worries. And I think that's the biggest thing of all the research I've done, even in the weight room, is I'm looking at the exercises that can have the greatest effect in a multitude of ways, not just in one specific area. So I think because athletes, just like human beings, have a limited amount of time they have in a day, they don't want to, they can't, and trainers can't spend the amount of time in the weight room that most people think they can, because they have all these other things going on, you know? And so it's what can I get the most bang for my buck to improve the most amount of things in the shortest period of time is what I do with elite level athletes, just like I would with CEOs or recommended for, you know, other people in terms of that don't have the time to spend 2 hours in a gym. You want to get the most bang for your buck. And so I've really focused on researching exercises that give you that in order for them to get the greatest improvement.
Could you, and this might be a good place you tell me to segue, or it's not really a segue because it's all very related, force number. Can you talk about what that is?
Yeah, absolutely. And so when I was studying the speed and sprinters with USA Track and Field, what I found quickly was that once the sprinters hit a certain distance, right around 30 to 40 meters, they actually maintained and held the exact same split for the rest of the race. It was actually the athletes who ran the fast times, like the Usain Bolts of the world, were actually the ones who were slowing down the least. But really, when you looked at their 10 meter splits, it was almost identical all the way through to the finish. And so what I came to realize quickly was that there was a correlation there between who could hold their top end speed the longest and who was winning the race. And so when I was looking at that, I then inversely was looking at the athletes and measuring their mass specific force in the force plate treadmill, what I realized quickly was, okay, there's relation to the athletes who have the highest strength to weight ratio or the force to mass specific force, force to mass ratio on the treadmill, that also are covering the same, lowest splits in their 10 meter, their flying tens in the 100 meter dash. That all of the athletes came to me after that and were like, this is awesome, this is great, you know, but like, hey, how do we improve this? And it was kind of a light bulb that went on for me really quickly, was that I think what most researchers, scientists spend time looking into is diagnostics and assessments, but what most people really need is ways to improve it. So unless you come with a diagnostic that you can actually show them improvement and show them how to improve it, they're almost meaningless. And so what I spent the next 5 years doing was spending time in the weight room and correlating the data between every exercise. So I tested the same athletes in the weight room with squat, power clean, hang clean, front squat, leg press, leg extension, RDL, everything you can think of under the sun, and measured their one rep max in those exercises in their body and their body mass, and compared that to the force plate treadmill study. And it didn't correlate until I actually got to the hex bar deadlift,
which is also called the trap bar deadlift.
Yeah.
For some folks out there. Yep.
Exactly. It's a circular bar that you step into with the handles on the side of the body instead of the bar being in front.
Right.
And then when I started testing the same athletes with the hex bar deadlift or the trap bar deadlift max in their body weight, it actually directly correlated to the force plate treadmill study at their max velocity and top speed. And so I realized quickly, okay, if this is the order in which they ran their 100 meter dash time in by their hex bar deadlift max and body weight, and I improve their hex bar deadlift max without increasing body weight, would I see the same improvement in their speed? And over, you know, the past 7 years of testing that, I have.
If you have a not totally sedentary, but former competitive athlete who would like to use a protocol to improve this relative strength that we've been talking about, sort of pound per pound strength output using the trap bar deadlift or hex bar, mm-hmm. What might the protocol look like?
You know, for most people, I would generally start them with somewhat of a hypertrophy or strength phase for a while, just to get them used to the lift and get their lower back strong enough to be able to get to the power phases.
What would that first hypertrophy phase look like?
Yeah. So I would go, I mean, I would do probably 3 to 4 sets of 8 of your 65% of your max for 1 to 2 weeks. And then I would shift up 5% every week leading up to about 85-90%, where I would go for reps of 5 or 3. So based on the percentage of that you're lifting, so let's say it's 65%, you're going to be between 6 to 8 range there. When you start to get 75-80%, you want to be in the 5 to 8 rep range. And then when you get above 85% to 95%, you want to be between 2 reps and 5 reps. So more than anything, what you're trying to do ultimately is, with the amount of cross-sectional muscle fiber that your body currently has, you're trying to stress your nervous system, recruit the largest motor units possible. And to do that, you have to lift heavy. You have to lift heavy weights in order to recruit the larger motor units, because ultimately what most people do when they exercise and they lift weights is that they're stressing their body eccentrically, isometrically, concentrically, and they're adding lean muscle mass. They're also recruiting motor units, but they're also adding lean muscle mass at the same rate. What we're trying to do, and the cool part about the hex bar deadlift, is at the very top, when you push away from the ground and you're in a standing position away from the ground, I'm going to coach you guys to let go of the bar to drop it. So there's no eccentric movement in the exercise. So that way you don't tear sarcomere, add lean muscle mass. So you're stressing the nervous system to get stronger, recruit large motor units, but you're not actually tearing muscle fiber down and adding more muscle mass. So I would go every 2 weeks, I would just adjust 5%, and go up 5% for about 4 to 8 reps for 65%. I would say 4 to 6 reps for like 70-75%, 4 to 5 reps for 85%, and then 2 to 3 reps for 95-90%, and just progress that way. And everyone, it's all relative, so it doesn't mean everyone's going to lift to 500 pounds, but ultimately what you're trying to get to is an elite level football player, like a 4.5 40-yard dash, 4.4 40-yard dash would be a 3.2 times their body weight in their hex bar deadlift to run that time.
3.2 times body weight.
Yeah, and what I find is in most, like, you know, healthy adults, they can generally pull about, you know, anywhere from 2.2 to 2.6 times their body weight in a hex bar deadlift max.
And what would be a good objective if perhaps 3.2? What would you, from the outset, if you said in a year's time, I would like to get you to X times body weight? And does it differ for men or women, or is it the same?
No, actually, you know, it's kind of funny. It's the same. The funny part is when I have, like, so right now I'm training a lot of the top NFL draft hopefuls, guys that just finished their college career. And they come in the weight room, they'll see, you know, some of the female Olympic sprinters that I have training, and the females who are 135 pounds are deadlifting 440 pounds. And they'll walk in the first day and they'll hit 385, and it immediately humbles them to realize, what have I been doing for the past 4 years of my life? Because those women over there are deadlifting 100 pounds more than I am. But it's pretty funny. But
and they weigh 80 pounds less.
Exactly. Yeah. So no, I think, I think reasonably over the course of, so here's a question what could people get to over the course of a year?
Yeah. Or what would your goal for someone who's reasonably fit, but by no means an NCAA or sure. Olympic sprinter.
No, I think over 2 is a great goal for somebody like that.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And that is for one rep maximum, or for a given rep range?
Yeah. So I think over 2 times their body weight for one rep maximum. So to give you an example, let's say you're 100 pounds, your goal is 200 pounds. You know, for sets of 5, you want to do 170 pounds for 5. That would be, you know, to get you to 200 as your max.
Got it.
Would be 85% of your max.
Got it. So 85% times 5
reps.
Got it. And when someone goes through the muscle building, general sort of hypertrophy, base building, once they've done that and they're working on the relative strength and the neural drive and the recruiting of these motor units, and focusing on that, how many times a week are they doing a trap bar deadlift workout, and what would such a workout look like?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, for the elite level athletes, generally I'll have them do it anywhere between 1 to 2 times a week. Just depends on the amount of time I have with them. For certain athletes, like, you know, Serena Williams, when I work with her in the off season, I'll generally have her like in November or December. So I only have 2 months with her. So I'll kind of ease her into it and build up to 2 times a week towards the end. But if you have a long period of time, I would go 1 day a week and then alternate with another complex exercise the second lower body day you do that week. But I think 2 times a week, and you know, if you're starting a hypertrophy phase, I would say 4 times 8 at 65%. I like to pair it, you know, with some sort of plyometric to continue to recruit those, you know, fast twitch, those larger motor units. And then from there, I go into all like auxiliary single leg unilateral exercises to help, you know, fix imbalances or train the body in a way that we're not working bilaterally besides that one hex bar deadlift. So I would do a hex bar deadlift with a plyo and then a couple single leg exercises.
I'd love to dig into some details. So
sure.
Let's just say, let's pretend, since I need the pat on the head, let's pretend like I'm an elite athlete, which I'm not, but let's just say I'm ready.
Sure.
I'm coming in to do this workout and my body's prepped for it. So I walk in what does the warm-up look like? And then when you get into the deadlifts, what are the sets and reps and rest intervals? Like, walk me through the details of what that, and of course it's highly individualized, but you can just make up some, we don't even need to get into the numbers. You could use percentages, but what would the warm-up and the whole thing look like?
Yeah. So generally I like to do some sort of a dynamic warm-up. So some sort of movement warm-up, not just getting on a treadmill or on a bike and running or biking. I like to, you know, do some walking lunges with a twist, some walking toe touches, some quad, you know, stretches, walking A skips, straight leg skips, that type of thing to kind of get some blood flow, and to help increase range of motion. You know, I have athletes start with on a foam roll, just to get, again, blood flow, just to warm the muscles up a little bit. Or a power plate, some sort of vibration plate, if you have that access to that, and then a dynamic warm up. And then I would then get into some activation. So I do some like light glute activation where you do some hip bridges or something like that, just to fire up the glutes. And I do some quad activation which would be like some no weighted step ups. You do like two sets of eight of that by itself. And then you'd get into the hex bar deadlift warm up, which would be probably two to three sets at, you know, 50%. Then 55 to 60%, and then we were working.
How many repetitions for those warm up sets?
Between 5 and 6.
Okay, got it. Five to six reps of 50% of your working weight.
Correct. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then once you get to 65%, you'd start your round. And so,
how many minutes of rest between the warm up sets?
I would say a minute.
Okay, maybe. Got it. Pretty short.
Yeah. Yeah, you're going under a certain.
And those are full eccentric, concentric eccentric, or you
correct.
Drop. Okay, got it. So you're not dropping the bar on these.
I am not. No.
Got
no.
it. All right.
And then once you get into the working set, then it would go concentric only, and I would go and obviously you'd get right back into position. So it's stand up drop 8 times in a row.
8 repetitions.
Yep.
With what percentage of your one rep max?
65%.
Okay, got it. Okay.
Yep. For the first 2 weeks, so it would be like in a hypertrophy phase, and then I would rest 30 seconds, and then I would pair that with like a level one plyometric, which would be like a basic squat jump, and I would do that 5 times. And more than anything in plyometrics, what I think I really want to kind of get across today is that the goal of doing plyometrics and training, and if whether you're an athlete or just looking to improve, you know, your human performance, I think the biggest thing you're trying to improve in plyometrics is amortization phase, which is the transition between your eccentric and your concentric. And so to do that, you got to be close to or near 100%. So I'm big on in between your plyos resting to do it as hard and as fast as you possibly can to improve it. A lot of times I think you watch in training programming, you see where plyometrics start to become more of a kind of a conditioning train. You right. do it to a point where you're tired, which is not going to help you improve what you're trying to improve, which is amortization. So I take rest in between. So I would do like 5 squat jumps where you're trying to explode as high and as fast off the ground as possible.
And you're doing that in between these deadlift work sets?
Yeah. So the superset would be a hex bar deadlift at 8 with drop and then 30 second rest. Then you do your 5 plyometrics.
Got it. And you're trying to minimize ground contact in those plyos, or how are you, what makes for a good rep in the plyometrics?
More than anything, you're trying to get to a depth that you feel like is natural for you to jump as high as you can. So I'm just looking for somebody to, you know, in fight or flight, they're trying to jump as high as they possibly can. I don't really care what that looks like.
you would not like what mine looks like.
I think people get too caught up, you know, in jumping. That stretch shortening cycle that occurs in our lower body when we jump happens in a window of 250 milliseconds. And when we try to perfect our technique and our squat jumps, we miss that window, right. Which doesn't allow us to explode off the ground as fast as we possibly could. So it's more than anything, it's just get down and up as quick as you possibly can. Kind of as if if it's fight or flight and you had to jump as high as you can to save somebody or something. So that's what I'm looking for. And then after that, at 65%, I would go with somewhere around a 2 to 3 minute recovery in between each set.
Right.
And once you get to 85 to 95%, I think like as you wrote in your book prior, is when you get to the heavier percentages, you want to go to more of like a 4 to 5 minute recovery between right. the ATP, CP, you know, phosphine pools to regenerate to as close to 100% as possible. So,
sorry, my dog's allergic. My dog hates phosphocreatine.
No worries.
No, she loves it. She loves freaking out. She uses a lot of phosphocreatine. Sorry about that. So yeah, as you get heavier, then you'd be taking longer rest intervals. And for those heavier weights, 85, 95%, are you still going to be, say, doing a work set, then taking, was it a 60 second rest you said before the plyos?
anywhere between 30 to 60 seconds. Yeah. So more than anything, you're just looking to recover to the point where you can jump at as close to a, you know, full effort as possible.
Got it. Then do five jumps and then rest 4 to 5 minutes or somewhere in that range, and then do the next set. And you do that for, in the case of the hypertrophy. Now, we were talking about four sets of, say, 8 repetitions. When you get down into the lower rep ranges where you're doing 2 to 5 reps at 85 to 95% mm-hmm. of one rep max, how many sets are you still doing? 3 to 4 sets? Or are you doing a higher number of sets?
No, I'm still doing 3 to 4.
Okay.
Yep.
So we finish the deadlifts. What happens after that?
Then I would go. So all the athletes that I bring in, I do force plate testing with them. So I'll do a combination of jumps on the force plate to give me an idea of kind of what their rate of force development looks like, you know, eccentrically, isometrically, concentrically, their peak force, a lot of different factors. And I'll take that into consideration when I'm building their programming for the rest of the exercise. But to just give an example, the rest of the workout will go somewhat unilateral. So I'll do it all single leg exercises. So the next group of exercises could look like a Bulgarian split squat. But for this particular athlete, for you, let's say I wanted to focus on the eccentric tempo. So what I would do with you is I would have you go, you know, lower down for 5 seconds and then stand up as fast as you can for 1 second. And you would do 3 sets of 6 of that. Mm-hmm. I would then have you rest again, 30 seconds to 60 seconds. And then I would put you into a position where you're seated on a bench, sitting down with 1 foot, 1 inch off the ground, the other foot's on the ground, and do a single legs concentric plyometric where you would stand up and jump as fast as you can from a seated single leg position. So imagine sitting in a chair, both feet are on the ground, lift the left leg off the ground by 1 inch, the right foot's on the ground, and you jump off the right and land on the right only. And I actually have Olympic athletes that I do this with where they'll actually go from a seated 90 degree seated position with 1 foot and they'll jump onto a 56 inch box. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, that is remarkable.
Yeah. And so I think,
I don't know if I could get off the toilet with one leg an inch off the ground.
No, trust me, me too. I don't demonstrate because I'm so embarrassed in front of some of them. I'm like, no, you demonstrate. I'll bring your other athlete in. So working on creating power from a static seated position,
right.
Very similar to how you would if you were sprinting. So that's a good example of the second grouping of exercises that I would do for this lower body day.
Got it. And then after the isolateral exercises,
then I would go into some sort of stability exercise, proprioception exercise, where I would go I call them step downs, but imagine standing on top of a bench with 1 foot leg hanging off of the side, the other foot's on top of the bench, and just lowering yourself slowly down for 3 seconds and back to standing for 3 seconds. And I would do somewhere around 1 to 2 sets of 20 of those. More than anything, I'm focused on, now that we've burned through some larger muscle groups, in the lower body, I'm looking at now that some of the stabilization muscle, so VMO, glute med, and getting those fired up with a step down. So it's a single leg step down. So 3 seconds down, 3 seconds up, and you're just lowering yourself over the side of the bench and back up, standing on the edge of the bench. Imagine standing on the edge of a building, lowering 1 foot down 3 inches and back up.
Got it. And so VMO, that's what is it? Vastus medialis obliquus?
Yep.
And I guess one of the muscles, when weak, thought responsible for a fair number of injuries, it would seem, or at least I've
correct. So yeah, I think the biggest thing with the VMO that I look at, though, is more than anything imbalance. So I'm looking at asymmetry between the VMO and the rest of the quad. If you look at, and I have a great example of this with a lot of the NFL guys I'm training right now, but when they come in from college, is that they do so many core complex exercises that the larger muscle groups kind of dominate. Mm-hmm. And some of the smaller muscle stabilizers don't get recruited as much as you'd like. And so you'll see like a guy with a huge quad and a 12-year-old Girl Scout size VMO. it's pretty unbelievable. And that for me is a big sign that joint stability, instability, but number two is they're at high risk and high probability for lower extremity injury. And so that's something we'll focus on a lot.
Got it. Where could someone, do you have any descriptions or any video, or can you point someone to any resources if they wanted to learn how to do, because I want to learn this single leg step down in the way you're describing?
Yeah. If I don't already have a video up on YouTube, I will put one up there for you. And then also too, you know, I work with Nike on their app that they have, which is the Nike Training Club, not to plug or anything, but that has a ton of the exercises in it. It's actually a great kind of resource for different exercises and things that I do that's in there, which you can pull from, and it's free. So it's, you know, doesn't cost anything.
What is your YouTube account?
Prolific Athletes.
Got it. All right. So we'll get on that. By the time this comes out, guys, we'll make sure something is up for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I'll finish with Seven Way Hips, which I think you know all about.
You'll finish with what?
Seven Way Hips, which I think
you... Can you describe it? Yes, I do know all about it because I gave the treacherous Peter Tia credit.
Yeah.
So Dr. Peter Tia, mutual friend, of course, who I described... Well, I shared a lot from Peter in Tools of Titans on pages 61, 62, 63. And these are glute med, at least glute med primary exercises that you taught Peter. So that's the seven way hip.
Yep. That's it. Yep. And I'd finish with that.
And you do that how many times a week? We're only talking about the trap bar workouts, but let's say you're doing this once or twice a week. Is once a week enough for the seven way hip, or would you do it more?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I think glute meds are one of the muscles, I think, for most people causing a lot of issue they don't even know about, especially when it comes to lower back issues and underdeveloped glute meds. So I think one of the big things I would do is I would do at least 2 days a week of it. But I have two different variations of it that more and more research is coming to find that you actually want to train the glute med as much as you can in closed chain. So I have some exercises too. I will also post on that YouTube account to show you that are closed chain, which means feet in contact with the ground to focus on that glute med. And it will do, so maybe like, you know, seven way hips one or 2 days a week, and then a closed chain glute med exercise the other day of the week, I think would be perfect.
Great. Yeah, I know that Amelia Boone, who also appears in Tools of Titans, so three-time World's Toughest Mudder Champion, does quite a bit of the closed chain glute med work.
Awesome.
And I think videos would be super helpful there. So we'll make sure that's up as well. Now, you did say that glute med, one of those muscles that when weak leads, can commonly lead to injury. What would you say for not necessarily professional athletes, but just athletes per se, right? Whether they're doing CrossFit or jujitsu or doesn't matter, tennis, fill in the blank, right? Someone who is a recreational athlete, what are some of the most common culprits in terms of whether it's imbalances or weaknesses that if you were to put down a short list, like the four or five that when neglected are most responsible for the injuries that you see, would glute med be in that top four or five list?
Oh, absolutely. I think glute med would be in top two.
Okay. What's the other one in the top two?
Ankle flexion.
Ankle flexion. That is my nemesis right there. Yeah. So no, by ankle flexion, you basically mean that sort of dorsiflexion and plantar flexion.
Yeah. And eversion and inversion as well. So I think the biggest thing is everything happens from the ground up. So, unless you're a swimmer, obviously that's the one kind of caveat here is that, you know, with your feet in contact with the ground as an athlete, or whether you're CrossFitting or you're running or, anything really, at the end of the day, where your feet are in contact with the ground, the number one place you look is feet and ankle flexion. So I think that's a big one, especially with the majority of athletes I see coming out, ankle flexion is really poor, and something we focus a ton on, because ultimately everything's connected, the fascial body's connected. And so when there's an issue in the chain at some point, other pieces up the chain are going to overcompensate. So whether it be, you know, more tension and on the knee joint, or it moves up into the pelvis, it's going to always start at the feet. So that's where I think number one is. And then glute med, number two, I would say VMO being another one, which is really hard to target. I think one of the big things about VMO, glute med's pretty easy to isolate.
Right.
VMO is difficult. And one of the ways that I do that is in some of your training, which when you're doing it, I think after you kind of burn through the quads, the glutes and the hamstrings, once your lower body begins to really fatigue is when you can then go in and target the VMOs. And you have to be able to target them through high reps, because you're going with, you know, you're only using your body weight, doing some isolation exercises for the VMO, like the step downs that I talked about, which I'll share a video and I'll share one more other VMO exercise, which is really, really good. You have to go high rep, high volume to be able to target it after you've already fatigued the larger muscle groups, because otherwise they'll overcompensate and take over the load. So that's a big part of that to improve.
And is the step down, is that also called the Peterson step down, or is it technically different the way that you do it?
It very well could. I'd have to look that up. But imagine like kind of a pistol squat on the hang with one foot hanging over the side of a bench, but you're only going down to like a 45 degree angle.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Very cool. All right. We'll make sure that is up. So you have ankle flexion, glute med, VMO. Any other usual suspects that you find in that list?
You know, this one's not so much of a muscle as much as it's just, internal rotation of the femur. I think one of the biggest things I find with the athletes I work with, number one, is that they have minimal internal rotation of the femur, which is very easily, you know, stretched, and you can find ways to kind of create equal external internal rotation of your femur within your pelvis. But most athletes come into me, you know, really turned out, really lack internal rotation. When you watch a lot of slow motion video, which I do a ton with the athletes I train, when you're watching an ACL injury happen on the field of play, what you see is massive internal rotation of the femur, and that's where the rupture occurs.
Internal
rotation of the femur. So you see kind of the knee cave in, go into valgus, and then that's where the you know, your femur tries to internally rotate. If you have range of motion there, if you can internally rotate, you're going to actually avoid an ACL. I have a couple athletes that took some big hits, like Russell Wilson, the quarterback for the Seahawks this year, that played through an MCL injury. That hit he took 9 times out of 10 would have been an ACL tear, but based on his ability to internally rotate, he was able to avoid that. It was an MCL sprain. He didn't even miss a practice actually with it. It was a pretty brutal hit, but that was because of all of the work we do. So like I always tell people is that I can't eliminate injuries with the athletes I train, but what I can do is bring that probability as low as possible, which hopefully keeps them on the field, you know, for long periods of time. And for any given athlete, you know, I mean, the worst thing that could possibly happen is, you know, is get injured. And so if you can lower that probability, I mean, that's the goal.
What is a good way to improve internal rotation of the femur? And this is probably also best shown by video, but what would, if it's possible to describe the sort of best bang for the buck that you have found, what is a good way to improve internal rotation of the femur?
Sure. There's a fantastic stretch you can do up against a wall that I will show a video of. It's really difficult to explain over audio, but I promise you I'll post all these videos up so you guys have them to see. But there's one you just basically back lying against a wall that you can do that is really helpful.
Okay, cool. So we'll get that in there. And then ankle flexion, possible to also share any best bang for the buck there in terms of improving ankle flexion? This is one I really need personally.
Yes, there is a fantastic tool out there called a ProFlex. I have no association with them, and they're going to be stoked that I'm saying this, but it's basically a
ProFlex, just ProFlex. Like it sounds.
Yep, it's a DCT ProFlex, and basically it's a board they created, a physical therapist created it. It's a board to allow you to gain leverage with your calf. And so you put your foot into it looks like somewhat of a little boot, and you put your foot into it, and then it allows you to stretch your calves in multiple ways, whether, you know, it's your tib or gastroc, but it really focuses and helps you kind of get stretch and strengthen through the full range of motion, plantar and dorsiflexion, unlike anything I've tried out there. Cool. It's kind of phenomenal product, honestly, and really easy to kind of to help you with that flexion.
All right, ProFlex, first one's free. That's on me. Then you can sponsor the next podcast. All right. this is related to a mutual friend of ours. Told me a story about how you told him, Robert Griffin III, RG3, which I thought was C-3PO or a robot because I don't follow team sports, was not going to last very long in the NFL. And you said it very early on in his rookie season. And it seems like that's going to be the case. So how did you know that he wouldn't last, or how did you suspect that?
So, I mean, you know, when you look at, it's very similar to how a doctor would look at a patient. If they're really going deep into kind of understanding what's going on with them, they look into past history. So you look into family history, you look kind of into, you know, past 10 years of daily, you know, habits, nutrition, exercise, all of those things. And when you look at athletes and you get an understanding of in the past what they've been exposed to and what they do, you kind of get a clear idea as to what A, they either need to work on or what they're going to be, you know, at risk of moving forward. And so one of the big things was with RG3 coming out was that he was known as a really fast athlete. He was actually an elite level world-class track and field hurdler at Baylor, an All-American actually. And so when he came out, one of the things that I noticed quickly was that just based on looking at him, just from an eye test, you could see the imbalances between the amount of power he could create, how fast he was. And again, we go back to VMO and glute med and the type of training he was doing. When you're a linear athlete, like a track and field athlete, running straight ahead for long periods of time, and that's all you do in train. And then you transition to a sport like football where you're very, very fast because you're track and field background, but then you transition to football where everything's happening in different planes. You're moving sagittal, frontal, and transverse. And it's a lot of multiplanar forces that are put onto the body that you have to train in a very specific way to improve those. And a big part with what he missed out on was just training in order to absorb those forces in multiple planes that I knew would cause an ACL injury. And so, and then watching his training, he kind of posted a lot about his training with like the heavy, heavy deep squats that he was doing. A lot of that, I mean, ultimately he was fast enough. He didn't really need to train to continue to improve his explosiveness. The dude already was a world-class hurdler. He didn't need to improve that. What he needed to improve was his ability to prevent and possibly avoid injury. And so instantly by just understanding what type of imbalances track and field athletes have, and then transitioning that to what stresses you're under in football, I could tell pretty quickly that he was at extremely high risk, more than any other athlete I've assessed of an injury. And unfortunately, ultimately it kind of panned out that way. But yeah, you can kind of get an idea of someone's kind of history and past of what they do and kind of some of their imbalances as to what injuries they're at high risk for.
I have an unrelated question and a very related question, but before I forget, I wanted to ask you, because I've had exposure to hex bars for a long time, starting in college, but I was recently gifted my first personal hex bar, and I have it in my garage in my gym, and there are two height settings. I'm sure you've seen this, where one set of grips, if one side is up, is roughly the same height as the rest of the bar, so to speak, including where you're loading the plates. And then there is one that is slightly higher. So my question for you is, when you're doing hex bar deadlifts, how many inches off the floor or how high are the grips that you would use for your athletes?
So I generally use high handle.
High handle. Okay.
Yep. High handle. So there's a high handle, low handle. I generally use high handle. And the reason is because predominantly most of the athletes I'm working with are generally over 5'10 to 5'11. And they're anywhere up to 6'7. So I'm usually using high handle just because I don't need to put them in that type of flexion. I don't need them to be that deep. And they're not that strong at that depth. And one of the main reasons why is when you look at the athletes on a football field, you rarely ever see them in those positions. So I'm not looking to strengthen that range of motion. We will work to improve flexibility and strength in different ways, whether it be manually to get them in those full ranges of motion. But when I'm training them neurally, it's more, I'm trying to increase the load as high as possible. When you think about the central nervous system, it adapts to stress. So if your lower body is capable of pulling from a high handle hex bar deadlift 500 pounds, but in every other exercise that you do, you're only able to get to about 380, are you actually stressing your nervous system to recruit larger MODI units if you're only doing 380 when you're capable of doing over 500? And what I found is the answer is no. And so with the high handle, what you're able to do is increasing the degree of your femur and the position your pelvis is in and your spine and spine angle and all that, is that you're able to go heavier, which allows higher neural adaptation, which you're going to recruit larger motor units. And so that's what I'm using the hex bar deadlift, not so much to, you know, increase, you know, hip range of motion or anything like that. What I'm looking to do is stress the nervous system in such a way that it has to recruit larger motor units in order to increase strength. So that's the goal. And so with the high handle, you can generally go heavier, and that's why I use it.
Got it. So even for a hobbit like me, I'm like 5'8", maybe 5'9" on a good day, if I'm like trying to put something on Tinder or something, but
sure.
Would you suggest in that case, I do have kind of Tyrannosaurus arms though, so maybe that means I should also use the high handle. Would you still use that with the shorter athletes, people who are under 5'10", or would you take them to the lower handle?
I may take you to the lower handle, but what I also may do is take you to the lower handle and maybe add like one of those, you know, 10 pound plates underneath it just to give you an extra inch. I don't want you too deep into it like you would see like in a deep squat. I want you to be in somewhat of an athletic like jump position, to where if you imagine like looking in the mirror from the side, if you imagine jumping and you go to the depth of your jump and that's where you'd feel comfortable, look in the mirror and see where that is and then align the handles to that, because that's the athletic position. That's where I want you to be. That's where you're going to recruit the most motor units.
And I've done more straight bar deadlift work than I have trap bar. Where should my hands be relative to my feet? In other words, slightly ahead of my feet, directly in line with the side of my ankles. Where do you suggest the hands be?
Yeah. So the one reason, you know, interesting thing about the straight bar is that what I found in testing it is that it had a lot more to do with your posterior chain. And what I love about the hex bar deadlift is that because of the position of the handles on the side of your body, it's more of an anatomically correct position, and it allows your body to kind of recruit more of its skeletal muscle to help you lift it. And so basically you want that, you know, grip the middle of the handles. You see the handles has some knurling on it. You want to kind of grip in the middle, but align your hands right next to the outsides of your legs. So they should be pulling you straight up through into your hips. So you imagine drawing a straight line from your kind of in your knee, bent knee position, from your ankles, shins to up to your hips. That's where you want to be. So it's kind of think more bar path than you do kind of, you know, start position or anything like that. Like without weight, kind of go up and down a few times and kind of see the bar path, and that's where your alignment should be on the ground.
Got it. Right. So if you were to extend your hands in the proper position and do sort of a high bar back squat type of straight down squat, your kind of middle fingers would be right at the bony process on the side of your ankles.
Yep. Exactly.
Got it.
So that's the kind of alignment of the hands.
Cool. And last on the trap bar, how important is it to drop the weights versus lower them very quickly? I'm not looking for a particular answer here. The reason I ask is that I've seen people drop, in quotation marks, and I've done this too, bar quickly versus drop, because it takes them less time to reset and do another repetition. That may just be increasing the likelihood of injury with doing really rapid eccentrics versus just dropping the weight. Assuming that we can do either where we're training, which is pretty easy these days with the proliferation of CrossFit boxes. Yep. They love dropping shit in CrossFit boxes. what would your thoughts on that be?
Yeah, you know, so it all depends. I think the heavier I go with some of the athletes, you know, the biggest limitation is their grip strength. And so a lot of times I'll use wraps with them allow them to go heavier, especially with the female athletes I train. When they can get up to the 400 range or high 300s, a lot of times their grip strength just isn't capable of holding on to the bar. And I don't want them to like increase their grip strength, because I'm not trying to add lean mass. So I add straps. So with straps, I'll generally have them like, you know, drop pretty quickly, keeping their hands on the handle. But for the most part, it's more about, you know, efficiency and energy expenditure. So I'm looking at if it's going to like require a lot of energy for you to like, to go down with the bar and drop with it and try to get back into position quickly, I'm more looking for effort on every single rep concentrically than I am kind of a fast drop. So really ultimately it comes down to you. If you're good and you're really quick and can get back into position fast by keeping your hands on the handle and just dropping with the bar, then I'm fine with that. I have athletes that do that all the time. I think it's just more than anything, it comes down to kind of comfort level with it. And more than anything, not expending too much energy in the lowering of the bar.
Got it. And do you have any preferred straps that you use, or is just the old school?
I love the old school cloth.
Yeah.
Straps. Those are my favorite.
Got it. All right. So I promise I would reel us back to what we're talking about. And we talked about ACLs. So I recently had my first ACL injury. There may be more to it. I did get MRIs. This was about 3 months ago. I was hiking in Colorado with a number of guys, very aggressive terrain, 45 degrees up, 45 degrees down, lots of shale and so on. and loaded backpacks, and I stepped up onto a log that was about a fallen tree that was, I'll say, 3 feet in diameter, something like that. I stepped up, and as I went to step off with my left leg, my right leg went through the tree and basically caught right below the knee, and I hyperextended the knee. It wasn't catastrophic. I was able to continue to hike, but I had incredible pain for weeks afterwards and had trouble even walking downstairs or walking around. I kind of had to peg leg around. And we're 3 months out. I can do controlled deadlifts, even up to, I haven't gone crazy, but I can get over 300 without any exhibiting any symptoms of pain. But I do have subpatellar soreness and this lingering concern about ACL. I have some plans to ski coming up in a few weeks, and I am concerned about it. This is the first time I've had knee issues per se. I've had a lot of quad issues where I've torn my legs apart, but knee, like structural knee issues, this is relatively new for me. So I guess there's a short-term question and a long-term question. Short-term is I don't feel like I have a ton of lateral instability, but I also don't really know what the hell I'm talking about because I've never worried about it before. So how would you assess whether or not I should ski or not ski would be short term. And then longer term is what are some good ways to minimize, to rehab an ACL injury?
Yeah. So again, so I'm not a physical therapist. So number one, I don't want to prescribe anything to you without kind of a physical therapist getting their hands on you a little bit. But I do think, I think physical therapy is an amazing field. I think there's a lot happening there that I think will become one of the larger kind of more and more performance will be going towards physical therapy than it will be going the old school kind of powerlifting route. And so I think, if you can get into a local physical therapist, I think that would be ideal. I think one of the big things is what I find is if it's not a rupture of the ACL, it could be, some sort of a grade one or two sprain of the MCL, which, is all kind of worked through by movement and rehab. So I think any type of, non-weighted stability, strength you could do of the VMO and the quad would be ideal, and also of the glute med. But I would kind of, if best you can, get under some professional guidance for that, like at a local physical therapist, if you have one nearby or a buddy of yours, that's one. But I think a good test would just kind of be, lightly, testing it with just some like light hopping or some light, like jumping and landing on your single leg, like forward and back, and under feeling how much pain you have there. Yeah. For the most part, but I definitely just get it checked out. I think that sounds, hyperextension is difficult because it's, again, what one of the biggest things I'm trying to help the athletes avoid is non-contact knee injuries. But when you have something that's like, that shearing force jarring that femur forward in the joint, which is probably what happened when you hyperextended it. Those are tough to understand kind of all the different forces that went on to kind of cause that. So I don't know. But if you're not if you're feeling pretty decent, you're still able to deadlift, you said?
Yeah, I'm still able to deadlift. I deadlifted yesterday with like mid 300s without any pain, but I was doing partial range of movement, pulling basically to just above the knee from the floor. This is a straight bar. Sure. Yep. And dropping, because I didn't want to risk, any type of hamstring injury. And if I lift to the top, I'm probably going to be lowering it quickly. I just want to avoid the potential of eccentrically loading my hamstrings in some stupid way. So I was, mid 300s, pulling to just above the knee and then dropping. And these were relatively, they were low rep range. So 2-3 reps and then longer rest periods. But for all intents and purposes, asymptomatic after that. Like I feel fine today.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, my gut's going to tell me you just have a sprain, but I would get it checked out.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Question. So we've talked about exercises that are high ROI exercises that can help prevent injury. We talked about the ankle flexion and the proflex. We talked about glute med and the 7-way hip, VMO and the step downs, internal rotation of the femur, and the weird, it's not weird, it's just hard to describe on audio. the wall stretch, which we'll get video for.
Yeah.
If there are people who would argue, I'm not one of them really, but that any exercise done properly can be done safely. That having been said, there are exercises that seem to produce more injuries than others, right? So if you were talking not about elite athletes, but just aspiring athletes or weekend warriors in general, right? You have 1,000 people and you want to decrease injuries as much as possible. What exercises would you, or machines or anything, would you remove from gyms?
100% would be the knee extension machine.
Knee extension.
100%. That machine is the worst for you could possibly imagine.
Okay. Good to know.
Yeah. They're in every gym and I think it's kind of like it, they have to be, but I would never do a knee extension machine ever again.
Got it. Okay. So knee extension out. So knee extension is out. What, any runners up?
In terms of machines.
Or it doesn't have to be a machine. It could be an exercise. Any exercise that is just not worth the hazard or potential risk of injury.
Yeah, you know, I've actually worked with a lot of Olympic committees all over the world, and one of the things I always do when I'm with them is I go and seek out the Olympic lifting coach and kind of just pick his brain and talk to him, and you know, kind of across the board, Olympic lifting coaches would tell you to not Olympic lift unless you're an Olympic lifter. And the one reason they would say that is because they take elite level Olympic lifters and take around 2 years to properly teach them the technique in a certain lift, whether it be the clean jerk or the clean, you know, whatever, overhead squat, whatever it might be. I think the biggest thing I would say in terms of that, I train a couple of CrossFitters, and I've actually just started doing CrossFit recently just because the CrossFitters I started training were giving me so much crap that I've never done it that I was like, fine, I'll give it a shot and I'll, you know, whatever, because I can't talk trash about something unless I do it. So I'm currently doing that. So I actually am enjoying it, but I would say with my background in exercise science and training for so long, I'm competent in those lifts that I feel safe. I can do them, but when I'm watching people doing overhead squatting, it kills me. Like it makes my eyes bleed. I can't do it. And I see so many people who are just waiting for some sort of injury that it just kills me. So I would just say, if you're going to get into CrossFit, if you're going to get into any type of Olympic lifting, really seek out somebody who's Olympic, you know, lifting certified that can help you, you know, USAW certified to help you learn how to do it properly, and take your time learning it before you jump into it. There's a lot of variations you can do. That's what I always tell the athletes I work with too. They're like, well, wait, we don't power clean. And I'm like, no, if I can do other exercises, get the same result, but pull back all of the risk of injury, why wouldn't I do that? Like, I'm not trying to get you. I'm not training you to be a good lifter. I'm training you to be a good football player, basketball player, tennis player. I'm not training you to be a great, you know, lifter. So more than anything, it's trying to eliminate the risk of injury as much as possible. So I would say, if you're going to go into Olympic lifting, CrossFit, really learn how to do that lift and take your time to do it before you jump into the classes and just go for, you know, 5 rounds of, you know, 20 overhead squats. And then the second would be the knee, you know, knee extension machine in the gym is the worst possible machine you can ever do.
Besides the trap bar deadlift, and I know we've already mentioned a few, but besides the hex bar deadlift, if you had to pick one exercise or stretch to have everyone do, if you wanted to one shot, one kill, try to decrease injuries across the board, and or as many injuries as possible for say a group of 1,000 people, what would you have them do?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, 7-way hips, the one you put in Tools and Titans, I think would be a really, really good one, for most people to jump in and do. But if we're looking at like not some exercise I, you know, came up with in my room trying to torture people, I think, something that's common, I would say a Bulgarian split squat I really like. I also really like box squatting. I think box squat is a great way to kind of teach somebody the proper sequencing and movement, without, you know, putting them at risk of injury. So, I think those two would be good exercises for people to go start with, and then see massive improvement in.
What height box would you have someone start with?
Generally just, you want to look in the side of a mirror, sit down on a box and you're looking for a 90-degree angle.
I got it. All right. So you're looking for 90-degree angle, meaning quads parallel to the ground effectively.
Mm-hmm.
Got it.
Yeah.
All right. Now this is something I'd love to dig into. And, this relates to a story of how you helped Meb, and you're going to have to pronounce this guy's last name for me.
Keflezighi.
All right. Train for his, incredible Boston Marathon victory. So Can you explain for us, maybe tell the story of what inspired you to apply your sprinting insights to a marathoner and how you trained him?
Yeah, I mean, just really, really simply, stride length and frequency is a product of mass-specific force. If you can help someone increase their mass-specific force, naturally those two things are going to occur. When you're a marathon runner, on average, you'll take around 20,000 strides to run a marathon. Well, if I can increase your stride length because of increasing your mass-specific force and your normal running gait by 3 inches, let's say, right? So big increase, 3 inches in your normal running gait and your stride length. 3 inches times 20,000 is 6,000 inches, which is around 5,000 feet, which is close to a mile. So you're a mile ahead of where you were the last time you ran that marathon just purely by increasing your mass-specific force. It's that simple.
Got it. And how did your training differ, if at all, for MEB versus your sprinter? Sprinters meaning track and field, or football players, fill in the blank.
Yeah. So, majority of marathoners don't have a kind of desire to get in the weight room and strength train. I think a lot of, you know, kind of for a long time thought has been that it can only go to hurt you and injure you or add size, which is what most marathoners don't want. And so the biggest thing was just teaching him that by hex bar deadlift, training and just the concentric zone only, so not doing no eccentric loading, that he could, again, stress his nervous system, recruit motor units without larger motor units without adding any weight. So he started at 127 pounds, ended at 127 pounds. And by just introducing that one exercise, I didn't touch his running. I didn't touch anything else that he did in the weight room. It was just simply that one exercise once a week. It improved his stride length and his running gait, and in turn helped him run faster.
Love it. Love the simplicity of it. I mean,
yeah, super efficient, right?
Simple doesn't mean easy, but
no,
and I like the elegance of it.
That's the biggest thing. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things I've always kind of really loved about what you're doing, and it's the same kind of approach I take. And you look at a lot of people that they're successful in what they do. I think they take that same approach as you look at patterns, or you just look at what you're trying to do is you're just trying to look at the most important things you can actually have control over to improve, that has the greatest effect in the most amount of ways, but with the simplest approaches. Just keep it as simple as possible. And I think that really not only helps elite level athletes, but it helps everyday people. I think that's the biggest misconception. I always have people ask me, you know, they're elite athletes. And, when I started working with Nike, take apart what you do with elite level athletes and apply that to everyday people. And what I always try to say is that there's nothing different. I mean, with the exception of they may be genetically predisposed to have greater talent in catching a ball or throwing a ball fast or running fast or whatever it might be. Ultimately, their time in their day is the same as yours. Their ability to, and the how hard certain workouts are the same as yours. It's just that, you know, they're maybe training for just a little bit of a different purpose. So they're still looking for the most bang for their buck and trying to, you know, keep it as simple as possible, even though they're elite, just like the everyday are.
Definitely. Now, what do you, you mentioned Nike, what are you working on at Nike that you can talk about? I know there's stuff that's probably off the table, but general, what have you been recruited to do?
You know, I think the biggest thing is that the performance training and fitness field is growing, you know, really quickly. I think people are really starting to understand how important fitness is for their overall health. And so I think what my role at Nike as a senior director of performance is to really help kind of bring in and using like the Nike Trainer Network or the Performance Council of some of the top minds in the field to help kind of funnel information in and training modalities and ideas and workouts into an app experience for everyone to be able to use and kind of as a way. So it's a free app called Nike Training Club, which I'm working on, is basically a personal trainer in your pocket. So our goal is there's different technology we'll be coming out with soon that will be able to give you really in-depth assessment of where you're starting from, your imbalances, weaknesses, those types of things, and then kind of prescribe a training program using algorithms that will be unique to you and helping you improve whatever you're trying to improve, whether it's weight loss or, you know, strength gain or getting ripped or running a faster, half marathon, or if you're a game day athlete at the high school level trying to make your football team, it's going to be, geared and unique for you based on your assessment. So just kind of bringing together the best minds in the field that I can bring together and that Nike can bring together to kind of deliver that through a digital experience is the goal.
Cool. Can't wait to check it out.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier your eyes bleeding when you watch people doing horrific overhead squat attempts, especially if they're trying to do as many reps as possible in a minute after they're already about to puke their brains out or something like that. Which, by the way, people wondering, a lot harder to do a proper overhead squat than you would think. You need, well, most people would need very good ankle flexion, really good thoracic mobility so that they're not completely destroying their shoulders. Besides that, what other things, and it could be anything, doesn't have to be exercises, what other stuff drives you crazy when you see it at a gym?
Good question.
Besides guys in like affliction t-shirts doing preacher crawls while they stare into their eyes in the mirror. Besides that.
Oh man. I have a funny story on that. But you know, I think the big, well, what, oh, I hate people running on treadmills. That's number one.
Why do you hate people running on treadmills?
I just think it promotes just bad running mechanics. I think it's just some people kind of tend to like roll that way when there's a street right outside, they can just go run on.
Got it.
And there's a lot of technology out there that helps them track and I get an idea of exactly what they're doing on a treadmill just on the road. But, I think, you know, I don't know. That's tough. I think I already told you about leg extension machine. That one kills me. What else? Okay. Well, the good, I can't go to a high school or younger game to watch people run. It drives me absolutely crazy. Like I can't watch people run, that haven't been taught how to run properly. And they're just, you know, doing butt kicks behind them, all backside mechanic, that like just watching people not how to run, know how to run properly is my pet peeve. I think that one, I have a really hard time. Or like when you watch somebody going on a run on the side of the road and like, I really just want to pull over, stop and get out of the car and just work on their mechanics with them just for like 5 minutes. And it will save them so much pain and injury that, and most of it's just by overstriding. I think
explain what you mean by that?
Instead, so when you're thinking about, I talked about earlier, when you think about foot strike, when the foot strikes way out front in front of your pelvis, so when your foot upon ground contact is out in front of your pelvis from when you're looking at somebody from the side, that's overstriding. And I think that's the number one cause of injury in static running if you talk to a lot of physical therapists. And so just that alone, if you could help fix overstriding, that would help eliminate a ton of injury in static runners. So that's kind of a mission of mine.
What are some of the tips that you would give in those 5 minutes to fix overstriding? Is it more forward lean? Is it, I have no idea. I'm not a runner. But what would I know a lot of people who are certainly, what would some of the recommendations be that you would give that person in your 5 minutes, once you've convinced them you weren't going to mug them or that you weren't completely insane?
Well, that's the hard part, I think, is that it's difficult to do. I mean, a lot of times I was just telling my NFL combines the other day, they were asking me, they're like, what you're teaching me, it feels so uncomfortable and awkward. And I was like, exactly. You're slow. So therefore, being fast should feel uncomfortable and awkward. If we're blazing fast and it felt uncomfortable and awkward, we'd have a problem because you're good. I think that's the hard part, is that it should feel a little bit awkward and uncomfortable when you first are doing it right. So it's difficult to do it by on your own without somebody watching you from the side. But generally, it's just the feeling of your foot landing almost behind you, like directly under you or behind you. And you'll know most likely it's landing somewhat underneath you. So kind of get that feeling of foot placement underneath you or behind you. And I think that'll help a lot. Just don't reach out in front of you to run.
Got it. I'll give you two questions. You can answer either one. So one is, what is something you believe, and it doesn't have to be limited to what we've been talking about, but what is something you believe that other people think is insane? Or if you had to pick one thing you believe that a lot of trainers disagree with you on, what would that thing be? It could be either.
You know, I think, there's probably a lot. I mean, I think there's probably a lot.
Let's get into it. Whatever you want to whatever you can mention.
Yeah. You know, I think the number one thing is that my biggest frustration in the field of training and human performance is that I think everyone's constantly trying to be the expert and making things so complicated that you have to see a trained professional to understand. Yeah. I think my biggest thing is that it's not that difficult. It's very simple. And I think the simpler we can make it, the better it is for everybody, including those teaching it. I think we try to get so complicated, and, you know, kind of put our own spin into making it, we're the expert in certain things, that it just becomes kind of undigestible for most people. So I think my biggest thing is just make it as simple as you possibly can, whether you're working with elite level athletes or you're working with, sedentary adults, it doesn't matter. It's just make it as simple as possible, because ultimately you can only improve so many things at once. Just focus on whatever you'll get the most bang for your buck out of it. And I think start there and you can start to add things on. And I think that's the biggest thing. I think, for me, I think it's just keeping it as simple as possible. And I think we try to make it way a lot more difficult. I think people always say, well, you know, how can you just predict, someone's speed based on just expert deadlift and body weight? Well, there's an algorithm that goes into it, and there's been 8 years of data collected on, thousands of athletes that helped me drive to that. It's not just, just do this and that. And there's a lot that goes to it, but by me just keeping it really simple, by just saying, just increase your strength without increasing your lean muscle mass, and you'll improve your speed. I think it's more helping more people than it is kind of, I can't sell that. So it's not that I'm trying to sell anything. It's more than anything. It's just trying to keep it as simple as possible, so people's kind of remove the riffraff from their daily thing. I don't know if you saw the story, but there's a story today, on ESPN about the University of Oregon. And there's three players from the University of Oregon's football team that were hospitalized due to rhabdo.
So that's rhabdomyolysis. You want to describe what rhabdo is for people who don't know?
Yeah, sure. It's basically caused by super intense workouts, overtraining to the point where your muscle tissue breaks down, gets in the bloodstream and releases toxins, and can actually lead to kidney failure. It's something we haven't seen in, I'm not kidding, I think like 80 years.
There's a few CrossFit gyms
occurs here and there. So there was the three players that were hospitalized, and basically the coach that was training them was trying to break them down basically. And, doing certain exercises that just really at the end of the day, he was just trying to break them mentally. And it was really for no reason other than that. There's no sports performance, aspect behind it. But a lot of coaches out there, when I talk to a lot of high school, strength coaches, or a lot of college strength coaches, when I go around speaking in different places, it's just that I think we get so caught up in kind of what we used to do.
Right.
That we miss out on ultimately what's best for the people we're working with, and how can we be on the, front edges of that, of improving it. I'm not comfortable sitting here today saying I accept where we are, and as far as we've come in training, that I'm willing to sit on my laurels, just use what we have currently. I want to push the limits. I think we're on we've barely even scratched the surface on human potential. And I think a lot of that has to do with just regurgitated information and not people looking and seeking out better ways to do something. And I think that's my biggest thing, is it's not so much that I never speak in absolutes. I don't think we've ever reached a finish line, especially in this field. I think it's always, you've got to always kind of focus on, this is what I'm currently doing today. I hope in 2 years, I have a better way to train athletes than just the X bar deadlift. I really, truly do. I hope the force number is obsolete in 2 years, because I hope we've moved on to something that is better and more and safer, and more people can do it to help them improve their performance. And then at the end of the day, my goal would be, is if you can even the playing field of genetics and talent, and you can actually teach people how to be faster, then it's just going to come down to who works the hardest is going to win. And I think that's what my goal is ultimately, is to remove the veil of kind of mystery of what makes somebody elite, and show, okay, here's what you need to do. If you could do these three things, do this over long periods of time, and it's just who's going to put in the most work is going to reach that goal. And I think more and more, in other fields, we're seeing that. But I think my goal with training is just to kind of continue to push the envelope and not accept kind of what is, and kind of keep pushing forward.
Which trainers or books have most influenced or impressed you? And the reason I ask, I have Charlie Francis's book on speed.
Oh, I love Charlie.
He was amazing. And some of you may recognize that name, because he was the trainer of Ben Johnson. Now, at that level, you don't have to comment, but I will say with a fair degree of certainty, not the only guy doping in that race.
Oh my God. No. I mean, I think we've already gone back. Haven't they already gone back and seen that like seven of the eight people in that race were doping at some point?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I think that's the hard part with Charlie, is that people miss out on the genius purely based on kind of the story with Ben and people thinking he's a bad guy because he did. But when it was just the name of the game. I mean, I tell people all the time, if you're sitting in a major league baseball locker room in the late 80s, early 90s, and you're looking around and you hit 20 home runs the year before, and the guy next to you hit 12, and the following year he hits 40, and you're still hitting 20, at some point you're going to go, you know what, I got to get on what everybody else is getting on. Otherwise I'm not going to be able to play very much longer. And I think, you know, it's kind of almost, it's they're the product of the culture. It's not so much an isolated incident as much as people think it is.
Yep.
So yeah, outside of that, no, Charlie Francis absolutely was a huge, massive influence on me. Another three-time Olympian hurdler, a guy by the name of Tony Campbell, who's still a track and field coach, was a huge influence on me. Dan Pfaff is one of the, I think, brilliant minds of not just track and field, but training period. He runs Altus down in Phoenix, which is one of the largest kind of attended track and field centers in the world.
Altus, A-L-T-U-S?
Yeah, A-L-T-U-S. And Dan Pfaff, it's P-F-A-F-F. Brilliant guy and mind. But you know, I study everybody, Tim, honestly. I've got from, you know, Louis Simmons to Charles Paulson to all of them. I mean, for me, it's kind of like success leaves clues. And I think you've got to kind of study the best that have done it prior to you and see where we're at and then see what we can kind of add on to. You know, Buddy Morris, who's a strength coach of the Arizona Cardinals, a really good friend of mine, you know, phenomenal coach. He's, you know, been in the game for a very long time, is in his 60s, was kind of a Louis Westside barbell guy, but has kind of adjusted to really evolve, and he's doing some phenomenal things with them. But yeah, I mean, there's a ton of coaches that I respect incredibly. I think it's been awesome. I think more than anything, we as a field of performance coaches have to kind of, and what my goal is with Nike is try to bring us together to kind of get, you know, bring all that information together, try to kind of come with some best practices and try to help move this field forward.
Mm-hmm. What is there anything in particular from Louis Simmons? For you people who don't know who Louis Simmons is, you gotta look this guy up.
Oh, he's awesome.
And I'm not gonna say too much more. He's very well spoken, very smart. A, check out his tattoos. A, read what he has to say about anabolic steroids. And then look at the athletes who have come out of his gym in the last 20 years and just prepare to have your mind blown. Yeah, if you've ever seen people using chains or bands, chances are they borrowed it from Louis Simmons. Mm-hmm. Or if they, but is there anything in particular that you have borrowed or adapted from Louis that comes to mind?
Yeah, absolutely. When I went to meet with him, you know, one of the big things he was talking to me about is that and this was just recently, but all of his world record and you know, world-class squatters that he has, he box squats all of them to improve their squat. So as basic of a lift as box squat is, he uses that to help them improve their deep squat in their powerlifting competition. So that was one thing I started implementing more and more with a lot of my jumpers, a lot of my football players is using more box squat than deep squat or any type of variation of squat. I use the box squat a ton, not only as a teaching tool, but just to help them improve their other exercises with minimizing the risk of injury and training.
Question on box squat, just a technical nuance. Are you with your athletes when they box squat, how much of their weight do you have them transfer from their feet to their ass on the box? If at all, or is it just making contact and then reversing the movement?
It just depends on the weight I'm using. And also kind of what I'm going for. If I'm using it like to do tempo. So if I'm doing like 4 seconds down controlled tempo, I may have them, just touch and go, or I may have them, it just depends on where I'm at in the phase of training or if what I'm trying to do to teach. Sometimes a lot of times with newer athletes to box squatting, I'll actually have them sit completely down on the bench or on the box. Kind of sit upright so their spine angle is perpendicular to the ground, and then lean back forward and stand back up, just to kind of get the understanding of the sequencing of the movement that I want. From what I understand, that's what Louis does as well, is he actually has them sit completely down on the box. I kind of do a combination of the two. It just kind of depends on the kind of phase of the training I'm in. But for the most part, of the listeners, I would say I'd probably sit all the way down in the box and then, you know, tilt your supine and go back forward and stand back up.
When you're working with elite football players or sprinters, certainly, I would imagine they already tend to be very low body fat. There are probably exceptions depending on.
Oh, you'd be surprised.
Yeah, there are probably exceptions depending on the position. But if we're talking about the not ground reactive force exactly, but the amount of weight they can lift relative to their body weight. Are there cases where you focus simultaneously or not on dropping as much body fat as possible, since that would ostensibly contribute to their ability to run faster, right? I mean, you're just tweaking a different variable.
No, 100%. Yeah. I have a good example of that, actually. A couple of years ago, I had two quarterbacks coming into the NFL draft, Marcus Mariota and Jameis Winston. And one came in at 207 pounds and needed to be 225. The other one came in at 260 and needed to be 230. So I actually had one needing to gain 20 and the other one needing to lose 30 and had them at the exact same time. And so, this ultimately can work for either.
What did you do in both of those cases? I know you could probably talk for hours about it, but if you had to do your best to summarize what worked best for those two guys, one trying to cut a fair amount of body fat and then the other trying to gain mass, what were the keys in those two cases?
No, I mean, ultimately it comes down to, I mean, as you know, nutrition plays a massive role in it. And so blood testing, I mean, I do a lot of blood test work with the guys. And so, as you know, with high levels of insulin and glucose, is really difficult to lose body fat. So understanding their diet from that perspective of trying to lower those markers as much as possible, eliminating sugar and those types of things that have them lose body fat is crucial. But at the end of the day, that's the really cool part about a lot of this training, is that a lot of it is going to get you to some sort of level of homeostasis. Your body's going to try to get to its natural state, a somewhat of a zero, based on all of this training. So whether you need to lose weight or you need to put on muscle, your body's going to adapt and do what it needs to do in order to increase its strength, especially when it's being stressed at certain levels with the hex bar deadlift. So with a guy like Marcus, who needed to gain 20 pounds, I added a lot more eccentric loading into his training programming. So he'd do a lot more tempo, time under tension, and focus on the eccentric phase of some of the exercises as well as the concentric. So in the hex bar deadlift, for example, I'd have him go up and down, because we're looking for more like cross-sectional muscle fiber. And then with Jameis, it was a lot of concentric only, eliminating eccentric focus from his training, and then just upping the intensity and also his cardio. So just giving him some more cardio throughout the day. And for him, a big part was just diet. I mean, a lot of these kids coming out of college, a lot of people don't realize is that they have no idea how to eat right or what is eating right. They've gotten away so much on talent up to that point that all of a sudden it comes to the point where, oh wait, I got to really focus on what I have to eat now. You know? So it's like, yeah, no McDonald's and KFC is not good for you. Which people, you'd be amazed at how much they don't understand that. But just helping him with his diet was a big part. So ultimately the training doesn't need to change as much. It's like when you look at CrossFit, for example, it's a great example. You'll see some people in the gym over 60 days that will put on tons of muscle mass and get bit stronger and bigger. And you'll look at the other side of the room and someone will lose 105 pounds. And it's like, how did them in the same workout, same program over the past 6 days get totally different, opposite results? And ultimately it's just because the body's trying to find that zero, that homeostasis. And so it's whether it's burning, fat cells or increasingly muscle mass, it's going to do whatever, the stress is asking it to do.
Right. What's just a couple more questions and I'll let you get back to your night. But the first question that I always ask is, what books have you gifted the most to other people? And these don't have to be sports related, but they could be. Are there any particular books that you've gifted to other people?
Good question. I've heard you ask this before and I didn't think you were going to ask me and I should have been prepared for this, but I'm a huge, huge avid reader. I truly believe, I tell every person I train, is that I think one of the biggest reasons you are where you are, the difference between where you are, where you are, and where you want to go is kind of knowledge. I'm big in reading as much as you can. And so that's a tough question. I think The Alchemist is a big one. I've loved that book for a very, very long time. The Bible mm-hmm. is a big one. But I'll give you kind of an off the wall kind of one, which is called The Slight Edge. Have you ever heard of that book?
The Slight Edge?
The Slight Edge.
Oh, Slight Edge. No, I haven't.
So basically the premise of the book is, and I give it to as many athletes as I possibly can. The premise is the small little tiny things you do, the daily habits you do every single day can lead to exponential kind of life improvement down the road. So it basically talks about forming habits before they form you and what types of habits you want to form. So whether it's things like you talk about all the time, which is journaling, nutrition, relationally, like all those things that will help you lead a greater, fuller, happier life, kind of making sure that you do those things and you do them religiously every single day. And over the course of time, like compounding interest, it'll add up to something great down the road. And it's all about just kind of forming those habits. And that's something I work with, my athletes on all the time, because ultimately they've all gotten to where they are. But what separates the great ones, the all-time athletes and people from kind of the, you know, the good is, I think, those kind of discipline and daily habits that they do every single day that kind of, you know, make them who they are. And that's what separates them from everybody else. They know who they are. They know that they can only do a few things really, really well, and they focus on those things. And without fail, they do them every single day.
You know, this, I'm so embarrassed. I can't remember the name, but A, I love the title. B, it reminds me of this anecdote or a story I heard about one of the most famous basketball coaches of the last century, certainly. And I'm blanking on the
John
name.
Wooden.
Yes, John Wooden. And this may or may not be true. I think it is that he would sit his players down at the beginning of a season, have them take off their shoes, and then have them lace their shoes back on according to his instructions. And the point of the exercise, because people are like, why the hell are we doing this? This is ridiculous. Why do I need to change how I lace my shoes? And he said, improperly fitted shoes cause blisters. Blisters cost points, and points cost games. And the moral of the story being that it's the little things done consistently that make a huge difference. You have to pay attention to the details. So I love that. The slight edge.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, slight edge. And it's a redundant book. It just kind of covers the same things over and over again. But it's just, it's kind of, there's all those self-help books out there that kind of give you like breakthroughs in certain things. This one is awesome because it kind of gives you the before all of that happens, you've got to be able to do these things really well. And it talks about like four or five things that you do daily that just will add up at some point. They're good habits that will pay off, exponentially in the end.
I love it. What advice would you give your 30-year-old self? And if you could just place us, where are you? How old are you right now?
I'm 34.
Okay, forget about that question.
20-year-old
self? Well, yeah, let's say your 20 or 25-year-old self, whichever one needs the advice the most. And if you could just try to place us where you are and what you're doing, 20 or 25.
Man, I think the biggest thing would be to... I'll tell you a funny story. When I first started doing this, my dad would always tell people that I was when I first started this, I started to figure out what I wanted to do in training. I even started out where I was like at a 24-hour fitness because I just wanted to get an idea of like what I wanted to do. And to this day, my dad still tells everybody I'm a personal trainer. I think it's pretty funny for multiple reasons, but I think I think more than anything, it's that whatever you're going to do, be the absolute best at it. And I think ultimately it always works out in the end. And I would have never thought a million years when I was younger that I thought I was kind of with not being an athlete and not being kind of, I didn't know if I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon, but not having none of those things really work out for me. I would have never guessed that I would reach the level of success that I have today based on what I was doing. But I took so much pride and put so much effort into like helping every single person that I came across to improve, that ultimately it kind of started to add up. And I think I just wanted to be the best, absolute best that I could be. Are you familiar with the author C.S. Lewis?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Talks about
definitely Screwtape Letters. Some great.
So one of the big things he talks about is what's called the inner circle. I think when I was talking to the athletes I work with, I'm always talking about, they're always striving to be within that inner circle, whether they see people like Jay-Z or Beyonce or, big time athletes that they like, Tom Brady or whoever, they want to be in that circle with those athletes because they see them, they're all hanging out, running around. But ultimately those people in that inner circle, they don't even know they're in that inner circle. The reason they're in that inner circle is because other people that were amazingly great at what they did recognize their greatness in what they did. And that's why the inner circle is a lot of times made up of photographers or actors or musicians or athletes or all these different types of people, because ultimately they're the best at what they do and other greatness recognizes greatness. So instead of focusing on getting into the inner circle, focus on being great at whatever you're doing. And I promise you at the end of the day, you're gonna look up and you'll be in the inner circle. And I think that's for me telling my younger self that is that just be great at what you're doing. And ultimately you'll be recognized for that. Not trying to, get into the inner circle in any other way, I guess, if that makes sense.
Makes perfect sense. Well, Ryan, this has been awesome. This is, I'm really glad we connected and had a chance to chat. I'm sure we will have a million follow-up questions from listeners.
Yeah.
And plenty of room for a round two. So whether it's in Oregon or in San Diego or somewhere else, it'd be fun to grab a bite to eat and do some deadlifts. But
yeah,
where can people find you, if there's a preferred place on social media you'd like people to say hello, or anything else you'd like to mention, where can people find you and more about your work?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I'm so working at Nike now, so it's a little bit different, but I'm on Instagram, Ryan Flaherty one, at Ryan Flaherty and the number one. And then by email, just ryan@prolificathletes.com is my personal email. So you can send email questions there if you guys would want. And I'd be happy to get back to you as soon as I can. I think those are probably the two probably best places to find me. Prolificathletes.com is still up, but because I'm at Nike now, no longer really kind of operating that website anymore. So I would just focus on sending the email or Instagram.
Got it. All right. Well, you may be getting a lot of emails, sir. So hopefully you have an autoresponder that helps you to ignore anything you really don't want to answer. But once again, man, thanks for taking the time. This has given me a bunch of homework and things to look into. And to people listening, as always, we will have show notes, links to resources, including the exercises that we discussed, whether it's glute med, VMO, step downs, internal rotation of the femur, etc. We will have these available, and we will figure out the best links for those and put them in the show notes. And you can find those show notes at 4hourworkweek.com/podcast. Or if that's too hard to spell, you can just go to tim.blog/podcast, and it'll have the show notes for this episode and every other episode. Ryan, thanks again, man. I really appreciate it.
No, my pleasure, Tim. Thanks so much.
And to everybody listening, as always, thank you for tuning in, and more episodes coming soon.
Hey guys, this is Tim again. Just a few more things before you take off. Number one, this is 5 Bullet Friday. Do you want to get a short email from me? Would you enjoy getting a short email from me every Friday that provides a little morsel of fun before the weekend? And 5 Bullet Friday is a very short email where I share the coolest things I've found or that I've been pondering over the week. That could include favorite new albums that I've discovered. It could include gizmos and gadgets and all sorts of weird shit that I've somehow dug up in the world of the esoteric as I do. It could include favorite articles that I've read and that I've shared with my close friends, for instance. And it's very short. It's just a little tiny bite of goodness before you head off for the weekend. So if you want to receive that, check it out. Just go to 4hourworkweek.com. That's 4hourworkweek.com, all spelled out, and just drop in your email and you will get the very next one. And if you sign up, I hope you enjoy it. This episode is brought to you by LegalZoom. I have used LegalZoom myself for many of my businesses, and many of the icons on this podcast have actually used LegalZoom. For instance, Matt Mullenweg of WordPress fame, CEO of Automattic, which is now worth more than $1 billion, first incorporated his company on LegalZoom. LegalZoom is a reliable resource that more than 1 million people have already trusted to help with their businesses, whether that's setting up a will, doing a proper trademark search, forming an LLC, setting up a nonprofit, or finding simple cease and desist letter templates. Man, do I use a lot of those. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but they do have a network of independent attorneys available in most states. They can give you advice on the best way to get started, provide contract reviews, and otherwise help you run your business. And important, there are no surprises. LegalZoom provides complete transparency. That means upfront pricing, customer reviews, and a satisfaction guarantee. Check out LegalZoom.com today to see how they can make life better and easier for you and your business. If you're pretending to be a lawyer on the internet, then you are asking for trouble. Put together the safety nets, get your T's crossed and your I's dotted. Enter promo code TIM, T-I-M, at LegalZoom.com to save 15%. That's T-I-M for 15% off. Check it out, LegalZoom.com. This episode is brought to you by Soothe.com, the world's largest on-demand massage service. What? And let me tell you, I have a high bar for this stuff. I have body work done at least once a week because I've broken my body. I have 30-plus fractures and 100-plus MRIs. I need body work, so I have a very, very, very high bar for that. Soothe, which I've tested, I tested, my assistants tested, my employees tested, delivers a hand-selected, licensed, and experienced massage therapist to you in the comfort of your own home, hotel, or office in as little as an hour. I've tested them in San Francisco. I've tested them in Austin. I've tested them all over the place. And I have to say, I was really, really amazed at the quality of therapist. And I do not accept mediocrity at all in this area. The process is super simple. Think of it as Uber for massages, right? You choose the kind of massage you want, say Swedish or sports massage, deep tissue, whatever. Then if you want, you can opt for a couples massage. I imagine that's an edge case, as the tech people say, but whatever. You set the length of your massage. So let's say you want 60 minutes, 90 minutes, 2 hours. And let's be real. If you want a proper massage, go for 90 or 120 minutes, for God's sake. And you select the gender of your therapist, and then click. You're off to the races. And they bring the massage table, sheets, oil, music, so you can unwind no matter where you are. And I have used this at Airbnbs, hotels, etc. Sooth is in 50 cities, including most major U.S. cities, as well as London, Sydney, Melbourne, Toronto, and Vancouver. So, number one, download the app Sooth, S-O-O-T-H-E, in the iOS App Store or Google Play Store, and then use the code, let me try that again, use the code TITAN20, T-I-T-A-N-2-0, TITAN20, all caps, to get $20 off of your first massage. That's a lot. That's a very good discount, so you should use it. So, again, download the app, Sooth, S-O-O-T-H-E, and try out the code TITAN20, all caps, for $20, not percent, $20 off your first massage. And if you're anything like me, I have been paying, and I've been enjoying. So, give it a shot. Try out Sooth, and your muscles, nervous system, and sleep will thank you for it. What the fuck kind of read was that? It was pretty good. That's what I think. Okay, enjoy. Bye.